The wolf sounded like somebody who had been to the gates of hell and looked inside and came back to tell us the tale.
His voice and his delivery and the power which he imbues when he tackles any song was just so undeniable.
He was the raw blues itself.
It's a scary thing. People hear him and it touches something in them that they've never felt before, and it's like, ooh.
Well, when I was 15 and 16 and heard this stuff, I was pulling my hair out.
Yeah, somebody knocking on my door.
It was so exciting. His voice just scares the bejesus out of you.
This guy, I had no idea who he was, somewhere in Chicago howling at the moon and shaking a fist at something.
It's like a sort of a big air raid going on. All of a sudden, it's this voice that's so huge and so frightening. He was screaming to the moon, that guy.
And when he sings songs like Evil, it does sound evil.
Evil is going on wrong.
Greatest artist I ever recorded. You had to appreciate the Howlin' Wolf. Or you had no ears.
When I get what I want, well, I don't come sneaking back.
Well, that's how Robert Cray, Jeff Beck, Bob Geldof, Bill Wyman, Bonnie Raitt, Skip McDonald and Sam Phillips reacted the first time they heard Howling Wolf. I'm Bruce Dickinson, and that voice belonged to Chester Arthur Burnett, otherwise known as Howling Wolf. And tonight and next week, I'll be telling you the story of the greatest Chicago blues singer, who died 30 years ago and was idolised by everyone from Jimi Hendrix, Eric Clapton and the Rolling Stones, to Led Zeppelin and Aerosmith. Chester Burnett had been known as the Wolf for just about as long as he could remember.
My grandfather gave me that name. Before he died, John Jones, because I was a bad boy, you know, and I was always in devilment. They finally killed the wolf and drove him up to the house, you know. I got afraid of this wolf. And every time I'd kill some of my mother's chickens, she said, so then that'd scare me, you know, and it made me mad, and it's good they called me Wolf. I was 3 years old then, you know. I didn't know it was going to be a great name for me.
I'm the wolf that howls. They found me howling at your door. I'm the wolf that howled, baby. They found me howling at your door. And if you give me what I want, I won't lay around and howl no more. I'm the wolf gonna howl, baby, for you.
Howlin' Wolf certainly turned out to be a great name because, as Chester grew up, it came to characterise more than just his behaviour. Jeff Beck.
He was a monster. He was huge. The build, I mean, monstrous, sort of Muhammad Ali plus, you know. And then opened his voice and you could feel the floor shaking.
His hands were big. It reminded me like of someone with a baseball glove shaking hands.
Marshall Chess of Chicago-based Chess Records.
And his feet, I have memories of these shoes with his socks sticking out of the side because his feet were so wide, they had to cut the side of his shoes with a razor blade.
Everybody was frightened by him. He was very imposing, you know, he really was. You felt very unsure about approaching him, you know, and because you didn't know whether he had a violent temper or whether he'd just knock you out the window or whatever.
Rolling Stone bass player and blues enthusiast Bill Wyman. And Wolf really came into his own when he was on stage. Bonnie Raitt.
I met him coming off of a set that was just incendiary, and he came walking in and there was sweat pouring off of him, and of course everything, his whites of his eyes and his teeth and his shirt were like that color blue that happens when you have black light. I was just bowled over at him in person.
Well, now meet me in the bottom.
You wouldn't want to see anything any greater on stage anywhere than just seeing the wolf get into it and his eyes roll up in his head, get all this harmonica and his feet this long, and then sitting down up on the front of his chair and getting with it.
Much of Wolf's character was formed during his wild childhood. Born into a desperately poor farming family, his mother threw him out when he was just 6 years old. Mark Hoffman wrote Wolf's definitive biography, Moanin' at Midnight, and describes how, after his mother turned him out in the dead of winter, Wolf walked barefoot to his uncle's farm, only to be bullied, poorly fed, and overworked.
Wolf had been cutting railroad ties to earn money to buy his first pair of long pants to impress his girlfriend. He put them on one Sunday and was dressed up to go to church. And his uncle said, go out and slop the hogs first. And the prize stud hog attacked him, and he hit it over the head with a bucket of slops and killed it. His uncle chased him down the railroad tracks, hitting him over the head with a stick. Chester took off on the train. Decades later, Chester, you know, Wolf wrote this wonderful song, Smokestack Lightning. He's singing to the railroad guys to stop and let a poor boy ride. And that's what he wanted to do. He just wanted to get out of White Station, Mississippi on that train in the worst possible way.
Having escaped his uncle's abuse, Wolf farmed his father's plantation in the Mississippi Delta. He cultivated not only the land, but a fine voice as he sang in the fields. But it was still a tough existence, and Wolf longed to make some money and get a better life. So when an opportunity came along, he grabbed it with both hands.
It was plying four mule on the plantation. And, man come through there picking a guitar called Charlie Patton. And I liked it, his sound. So every night that I'd get off of work, I'd go over to his house and he'd learn me how to pick the guitar. So I got good with it. So I went out for myself. Then along come Sonny Boy with the harp, Rice Miller. Then he learned me how to blow the harp. I've been playing ever since, played all over the Cotton Belt countries, you know.
That was Wolf in an interview in 1968. He travelled around with Charlie Patton, another great bluesman like Robert Johnson, and Son House, playing juke joints and perfecting his performance. Increasingly, his arrival in small towns stirred up huge excitement, and he became a local star. Hubert Sumlin, who had become Wolf's lifelong guitarist, remembers as a young boy the thrill of trying to catch a glimpse of his hero at a juke joint.
I kept trying to get in, and they wouldn't let me in, man, and it threw me back out. I said, oh, I'm going to get in here some kind of way to see Wolf, you know. I went around to the back, and I stacked me these Coca-Cola crates up, and I'd peep it over in through this fan that they had down on Wolf in the band playing. And somebody came and snatched those Coca-Cola crates out of under me. Over there on his head, me and the fan. So he brought me back home to Mama. He told Mother, said, look here, Miss Claudia, said, don't whoop him. Said, please don't. Said, because I may need him one day. That's what they told my mother and daddy. He whooped me, then my mama got me. But that didn't keep me from going back out there to see the man again. You know, I determined to be with this guy.
As indeed he would be. In 1948, Wolf moved to West Memphis and assembled an electric band with guitarist Willie Johnson. They got a slot on the local radio station, and a young Sam Phillips, who would go on to establish Sun Records, tuned in. Sam said, "The first time I heard Wolf, I thought, this is where the soul of man never dies." Determined to capture this thrilling sound, Sam coaxed Wolf into the studio and cut Moanin' at Midnight and how many more years?
Greatest artist I ever recorded, I guess. That takes nothing away from Elvis Presley or Jerry Lee Lewis. He was the raw blues itself. This guy was hypnotic. He put you in a trance. And to see him on a session, it was just the greatest show. You wouldn't want to see anything any greater on stage anywhere than just seeing the Wolf get into it and his eyes roll up in his head, get all this harmonica and his feet this long, and then sitting down up on the front of his chair and getting with it.
Yeah, somebody knocking on my door.
Phillips sent these recordings to Chicago-based label Chess Records. The keen-eared Chess brothers realized they'd struck gold and immediately took over.
I got beat out of this artist. Leonard Chess talked him into going to Chicago. I found out very early on that handshake deals didn't work.
We were an up-and-coming, strong record label who knew how to get the records on the radio. We were known for that.
Marshall Chess.
There were no rules, there were no regulations, there were no fancy artist contracts. It was really a industry being born. And we received this Howlin' Wolf record, Moaning at Midnight, where he was doing his howling and moaning. And my father and uncle were always looking for an original sound, and especially if it was blues-based. So they immediately wanted to release the record, and it became a hit.
Home. Back in Memphis, Sam Phillips was devastated.
I regret not having got to record the Wolf ad infinitum, because I don't give a damn if you loved Arturo Toscanini. You had to appreciate Chester Burnett, the Howlin' Wolf, or you had no ears.
And record sales proved that there were plenty who did have ears. In 1953, Wolf moved to Chicago, driving there in a $4,000 car and with $4,000 cash in his pocket. A new home meant a new band, and Wolf sent for the boy who'd fallen on him through the window, Hubert Sumlin.
So, Johnny, when I was about 17, man, me and James Cotton, we grew up together. We formed this little old band, and we used to play for these same roadhouses, some of them, that Wolf played at. We wasn't making no money. Wolf came, he said, I'm going to Chicago, and I'm forming a new band. I'm putting this old band down. If I sent for Hubert, would you let him come? He told me, he said, hey, man, you're going with Wolf. Please go on with Hubert, because you'll make more money with him than you will me. I said, thank you. And sure enough, man, I ended up in Chicago with Wolf. Oh, he had my rent paid up for a year. He had my union card for a year. Paid up. I was all right.
After a long way from home, can't sleep at night, grab your telephone, something just ain't right. That's evil. Evil. Get in your stall. That's evil. Evil is going on wrong. I am warning you, brother. You better watch your happy home.
With Hubert on board, the Chess brothers enlisted the songwriting talents of the great Willie Dixon. A series of electrifying sessions produced a catalogue of recordings, almost all of which would become Chicago blues standards. Though, as Marshall Chess remembers, it was as much about the money as it was about the music.
There was tension between all the artists. My father, uncle, even me later in life. You know, the blues business was a rough business. You're dealing with people with not much education. Some didn't know how to read or write, came from the South. You know, they were making very little money and very suppressed society. Came up to Chicago, which was like coming out to the Wild West, you know, clubs, the alcohol, making money. We were after making hit records. We were not after making folk music, an art form that would be discovered by white kids years later. We wanted to make hit records and make money.
Well, if you call on the telephone and she answers off slow, grab the first thing smoking off you, half the whole boat. That's evil. Evil is going on.
Evil was one of the first hits those sessions produced, and Wolfe did make a lot of money. But he worked hard for it. On stage, he went for broke every night, playing each show as though it was his last. Hubert Sumlin.
He did some things that I didn't thought that guy could do, man. He was a performer. He'd ride motorcycles on the bandstand. He climbs to the curtains, upside the wall. He did everything, man. I couldn't understand that how he did this. But what a guy. I remember when we made Spoonful. This guy had a spoon, man. Long tablespoon headed down his britches leg. He got the second spoonful. And I said, look where he get the spoon. Surprised us.
It could be a spoon. Full of diamond, could be a spoon full of gold, just a little spoon of your precious love, satisfy my soul. A man lies about a little, some of them cries about a little, some of them dies about a little. Everything fight about a spoon.
And Wolfe's antics went down a storm. Anyone who saw his band in the 1950s said he was unbeatable, the most exhilarating act on the circuit. Off stage, however, it was a different story. Professional and self-disciplined, Wolfe openly disapproved of his fellow musicians' decadent lifestyles.
Oh, Little Walter, I never did have anything to do with him because, you see, Little Walter was smoking dope and jiving. You see, I wouldn't want to be involved, you know, in that. My reputation is too high for to let somebody drag me with a weed. I'll take a drink of whiskey, but long as the day I live, you never hear telling me food with no cigarettes. You know, something that ain't good for me. Police catch me, then they gonna write a big story. The wolf chin, the moon pulled the star down, and I think he had the shining pain.
Wolf was just as demanding of his band.
I was standing in the back watching Wolf, and I had never seen Wolf live before that. And here he was on his knees, howling, white shirt on, his sleeves rolled up.
I'm a tail drag. I'll wipe out my tracks. When I get what I want,
on on the left side of the stage was Hubert playing guitar. And all of a sudden, there was some bad notes, bad chords. Wolf walked right across the stage and whacked Hubert right in the arm, right on stage. Wolf was rough. He was a real tough band leader. I always felt he was like a domineering presence over the band, and especially Hubert. Hubert was like his son, like his adopted son. And of course, Wolf only wanted it to be right.
When Wolf whacked somebody in the band, it was not malicious, but intended as fatherly discipline. All the same, he was often overbearing, as Hubert discovered when, having been distracted by drink and women, he'd failed to show up for a gig.
He said, "Hubert, you know I ain't gonna have this." I said, "Look, you stop the car, we'll fight. You know, we'll sell this now." He put the brakes on the car, man, and he knocked me down his heel. He waited till I got back up, and he went to hit me again. "Well, you got enough?" I said, "I got enough." First time we ever had a fight, man, first time. The next time, he knocked my teeth out.
Despite all that, Wolf was very protective of his band and felt responsible for them. He paid them well and took out unemployment insurance and social security, which was unheard of. He took his role as band leader seriously too.
I remember him sitting in my office telling me he needed money to take guitar lessons.
Marshall Chess.
He wanted to learn how to read notes. He was always trying to better himself, better his musical ability.
You know, the guy didn't have an education when I first got with him. But before he passed, he could read, he could write, he could do everything, man. Not only that, he could play his guitar. He went to school. He learned me so much. So much, man.
And the most significant thing Wolf taught Hubert was in the late 1950s, when he told him that until he learned to play without a plectrum, he didn't have a job.
I said, "I'm fired, right?" He said, "Yes, you are, till you do what I say. You don't understand? Do like I asked you to do. Go home, put the picks down, think about your fingers." I said, "Yes, sir." But he hurt me. God help knows, you ain't man. You be getting fired in front of about 700 people in a juke joint. I put that pick down. My fingers got sore. I played. I remember Smokestack Lightning. I said, "I've been doing this on Smokestack Lightning. I've been hitting this note. It's right, but hey, it's fast. It's a slow number." Next night, I went back to Wolf, and my finger was so. But let me tell you, I had my sound, his sound. I had what I wanted, and he had what he wanted. That's my riff, and I still got the riff.
Ooh.
Smokestack Lightning, with Hubert's indelible riff, became Wolf's biggest hit and remains one of the most influential blues recordings of all time. As Hubert discovered his own sound, he began to take on a more dominant role in the band. Bonnie Raitt, no mean guitarist herself.
Hubert, for me, up there with the top three or four guitar players of all time. I mean, those records, you know, you're talking to a diehard Wolf fan here. There's something about the interplay of Willie Dixon's writing and the way the bass and drums were played, the way Sonny Land played piano, the way Buddy and Hubert accompanied Wolf. But Hubert is totally unique. He always sounds like himself.
He added so much to those songs. He put those lines in those riffs that made them a bit special.
And as Bill Wyman said, with Hubert firmly by his side, Wolf was flying. Only one thing prevented him from becoming the undisputed king of Chicago blues, and that was that Chicago already had one. Muddy Waters had reigned for more than 3 years when Wolf arrived and had the hottest band in town. The two heavyweights competed throughout the 1950s, and as Hubert recalls, it all came to a head when Muddy tried to poach him.
Muddy tripled the money to get me to play. Him and Muddy was okay at that time. He had a chauffeur to come over with all these $1 bills, about $300 or $400. Oh, man, that's more money than I ever had seen.
And it worked. Hubert joined Muddy's band until a confrontational Wolf caught up with them in Chicago's 708 Club.
Muddy was drunk, had four or five whammies. He already had done got drunk before we got back off the road. He was drunk all the way. But he looked up when Wolf pointed his hand at him and said, "Hey, man, wake up. I ain't never seen a man get so sober. Hey, Wolf, how you doing?" He said, "Man, I come get my son, that's all. Say, you can have this guitar player that I got. Now, I ain't going to leave you stranded, but I come to get my son." Muddy looked at me and looked at Wolf. Oh, I just started crying. Started crying, man. I don't like this guy. All I know. And I left.
With Hubert safely back in the fold, a triumphant Wolf reflected on his relationship with Muddy.
"Well, I'm going to just break it down to you. Muddy's a nice person, you know, but he's a little jealous of me. See, but Muddy loves women. I got a wife. I didn't always have a wife, but I never was made up out of the stuff Muddy Waters was made up out of. You know, the man, he drawed a gun on me once. I give him 2 men out of my band once or twice. No, I never argued with him. I speak highly of Muddy. Muddy was just jealous of me."
And Wolf could afford to speak highly of Muddy. In the late 50s and early 60s, he was in huge demand in Chicago, whereas Muddy's star was waning. Indeed, times became so hard for Muddy that when his wife died, a well-off Wolf paid for her funeral. However rich and successful Wolf became, though, the poverty of his early years was never far away. Here's Jeff Beck.
The lovely story that Stevie Ray told me was even though he'd made quite a bit of money, the first thing he did was to buy an air conditioning unit. And he stood and had several framed pictures of him standing by this air conditioning unit. And he showed me them. It was fantastic. You know, he was so proud that he could afford air conditioning.
By the end of the 1950s, Wolf had conquered Chicago and stolen Muddy's crown. His records were played all over America. He was incredibly popular and had become a huge star with the black audience. In the meantime, though, little did Wolf know that overseas, a whole bunch of young white musicians were discovering his music. Next week, we find out how that was a phenomenon that gave Wolf a pivotal role in the British invasion of the early 1960s, and how his frightening reputation was so very well justified. I was Bruce Dickinson, and the Howling Wolf story is a Smooth Operations production. Go on, town.